Okay. So I will describe some recent results in biometric theory, but I think I'll end up probably describing just one of them. Okay, so first I'll give you a very brief review of the features that will be useful later. Where is my board? Okay, here. Okay. So what's the point? So the point is that we have a matrix G mu nu, and we want to construct the interactions of this matrix with another matrix F mu nu, another spin two field F mu nu. So we have the Einstein-Hilbert term for G mu nu. We want to construct a potential in terms of G inverse F, some polynomial of the two matrix. And then, of course, we want to add dynamic for the second spin two field F. Okay. And from the beginning, it's not clear how this potential should look like and how the kinetic term for this F should look like. Okay. Now, if this second spin two field F is taken to be a fixed matrix, a fixed spin two field without a kinetic term, for example, you can take it to be eta mu nu, then you get massive gravity, which is a theory of a massive spin two field G in a fixed background F, okay, or eta mu nu. Now it has been known for a long time that generically these theories have a ghost. So they essentially propagate six modes, which is five modes of the spin two field with one extra mode, which is a ghost. Okay? That's the Bulliver-Desser ghost. And now the question is, what is the necessary condition for the absence of the ghost? Not the sufficient condition, but the necessary condition. So this necessary condition, in fact, can be read off from the paper by Cremonelli, Nicolis, Papucci, and Trincherini from 2005. So the idea is this. The idea essentially is that you start from this guy, G inverse F, where F is eta, and you rewrite this with Stueckelberg fields, etc. You take the decoupling limit of this quantity, set the vector mode to zero, etc. And at the end of the day, in this quantity, the only thing that survives is just a scalar mode pi. Okay? And it appears in this combination in that quantity. So it's the identity plus d mu d nu pi squared. And of course, now your potential term, your potential for g inverse eta becomes a function of this d mu d nu pi. And these people essentially observed that if you write a nonlinear quantity if you construct a nonlinear quantity out of this guy, of course, you will have higher time derivatives. So the suggestion, therefore, was that in order to make these kind of terms harmless, you can contract the derivatives with anti-symmetric tensors like that. And this structure essentially ensures that you do not get two time derivatives acting on the same field. And in fact, this whole term becomes a total derivative. So this is the necessary condition for the absence of the ghost in this framework. Okay? And once you have this necessary condition, then you can immediately write down the complete nonlinear theory that is essentially fixed entirely by this necessary condition. And the idea is that, as was observed in the DRGT paper, there's a unique relationship between the d mu d nu pi and this quantity g inverse f. And because you have a square here, if you want to express d mu d nu pi in terms of g inverse f, you have to take a square root. Okay? So that's the origin of the famous square root. So essentially, wherever you have d mu d nu pi, you replace it by this quantity, which essentially is solving this equation for d mu d nu pi in terms of the g inverse f matrix. And once you do that, you get a unique nonlinear form for this potential, which is entirely fixed by the necessary condition for the absence of ghost. So it's as simple as that. So then, of course, you have to show that this ghost really is not there in the theory. But the advantage now is that you have a unique action to study. The problem is that you have a square root here, so the standard ways of analyzing these things become difficult. But the short story is that you can actually show that there is no ghost even at the nonlinear level in this theory. And once you do that, then you, of course, become more ambitious. You want to promote this eta to a generic matrix, or at the end even make it dynamical. And this is the final answer. So you have then an interacting theory of two spin two fields. The kinetic terms are given by Einstein-Hilbert terms in both cases, so that turns out to be the correct kinetic term for the second spin 2 field, and the interaction term, which is obtained essentially from here, can be rewritten in terms of ENs, and these ENs are elementary symmetric polynomials of the eigenvalue of the square root matrix. Okay? Their form is not important for us here. So this is the ghost free by matrix theory. Okay, and Rosen is there. Okay, and you can prove that this theory does not contain a ghost, it has the right number of constraints, etc. Okay, now.
So this is Aaron Minkowski.
Now this is completely general.
Completely general is not ghost free.
Exactly, yeah. So you have a completely general G mu nu and F mu nu, and you can show that you have the right number of constraints, it doesn't have a ghost. Around any background, completely nonlinear. Yeah. Okay, now this term has interesting symmetry properties, etc. Okay, now this theory is more than massive gravity, because if you take, for example, if you take this G matrix to be your physical matrix, and therefore fix this coupling MG to be like the Planck mass, the measure of the Planck mass, then in the limit that MF by the Planck mass is very, very large, then you recover massive gravity, that's the DRGT theory. But in the limit that the MF by M Planck becomes very small, then you actually recover GR. Okay? So in the extreme limit when this is zero, you exactly recover GR, except that along with GR, you also recover a cosmological constant, and that cosmological constant now is essentially given by, in terms of the parameters of this interaction term, okay? which has interesting consequences.
So you take that limit, the cutoff goes to zero.
Which cutoff? Which one?
The whole theory.
Okay.
There
are several cutoffs. The analog of lambda 3.
The lowest one.
Sorry?
Cutoff the lowest one.
You mean the lambda 3 one?
Yeah.
So the analog of lambda 3 actually goes to infinity.
The
lambda 3 of this guy, exactly. So the lambda 3 of massive gravity is of no importance here. The lambda 3 of this guy, the point is that this is different from massive gravity. You have to fix your parameters here by matching this guy to cosmology, for example. Okay? So you fix the right combination of these guys to the Hubble parameter, and then it turns out that the this guy, which would be the analog of that's the quantity, isn't it? That actually goes to infinity. So this is completely safe.
Okay, but what about just the interaction of transverse modes?
Yeah,
usual spin 2 part.
Yeah, exactly. So when MF goes to zero at high energies, this here itself can get strongly coupled. You can do two things there. If you take the extreme strong coupling limit, like you take MF equal to zero, okay, then you can solve the equation of motion exactly, and you show that you exactly get GR, which means that the effect of strong coupling is to make F mu nu exactly follow the behavior of G mu nu, while G mu nu itself remains weakly coupled. Exactly. Yeah, this is in the exact limit. The second thing, however, is that notice here that M Planck is very, very large. Okay? So MF by M Planck being small doesn't mean that MF is very small. Okay? So you can easily have MF of the order of a TeV, for example, and still this ratio is very, very small. Okay? So the MF strong, so the analog of high energy strong coupling of GR is not really a problem.
Exactly in this field, so let's not take the actual limits, let's just say there's an hierarchy between the two. No?
Yes.
And they're both fine.
Yeah.
So F and G play very similar roles in the Lagrange. No? So
Okay. The point is this guy. Okay. So the question is this guy, you can actually measure this guy in units of mg or mf. Okay, so in the standard massive gravity, you measure this in units of mg, and mg becomes a massive graviton, and then you get the strong coupling scale from the lambda 3 scale from here.
Yes.
Now in this limit, f becomes a massive graviton. Okay, but g is a massless graviton, and you make all your measurements with respect to the massless graviton. So the actual numbers change. Okay? We can discuss that in detail, but this was just a passing remark here. I'm going to do something completely different.
So, following that, so if you say mg is your usual Planck mass,
yes,
and then MF is much smaller than that. So what is the mass of F?
Which mass of?
F gravitons. What is that?
Oh, okay. So you can actually write down a formula for the Fierce Pauli mass of the massive graviton. Mm-hmm. The formula, of course, is not valid if MF is very, very small, because the formula is computed using fluctuations.
Yeah.
So as long as the theory is weakly coupled, the formula, but there is a definite formula for it.
But is it much smaller than MF, or?
It depends on several parameters.
So like if I say Planck is what it is, and MF is TeV, what would be the mass of it?
So with this, you can still have the freedom to tune that mass from a very small value to a very large value. Because the mass also depends on these beta parameters. So as long as you're not worried about naturalness, et cetera, you can make that mass to be whatever you want. Okay? But if you want the things to look natural and all that, then there are some restrictions. Okay? We can discuss that in detail. Okay. But this was just a passing remark here. Okay. Now.
Sorry, could I just so that the little m is the actual,
I put some M tilde. I can tell you in detail what this guy is.
What's the actual graviton mass?
Oh, that's a Fierce Pauli mass.
As you send MF to zero, what's the actual graviton mass?
It's a complicated expression in terms of the betas.
You're going to infinity, zero, or minus?
It can, depending on how you scale the betas, it can go to whatever value you want.
But let's keep...
You mean in this limit?
Yeah. So this argument, I think you scale the betas constant.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to know... In that limit.
Yeah. So if you scale, if they take your betas to be constant, in this limit, the mass actually goes to infinity.
Okay.
Yeah. But you can also make it large and small. So you have a wide range of things there, basically. And same for the cosmological constant, etc. Okay. I can give you the equations there. That's easy. Okay. Now, okay. So just a part of the review. If you look at the decoupling limit of this theory, then you have this Galilean duality issue, which Andrew and Paolo talked about. And if you look at the massive gravity limit of this theory, which means that you free the dynamics of F, then the causality issues here were in this model were discussed by Kisuke and George in the beginning. Okay, so here we look at some other aspects of local causality issues in this theory, which essentially is complementary to this analysis. If you extend the analysis of this analysis of causality issues in massive gravity dynamic theory, then what we discuss now will be complementary to that, basically. Okay? And hopefully we'll shed light on that. Okay. So what are we going to do here? Now, this is where I lose my boards, but it's okay. Okay. So given that action, there are some immediate problems. Okay. As you can immediately see, what are the problems? The problem is that you have two matrix, G mu nu and F mu nu, and they have exactly the same kinetic term as GR. So you have the same kind of causal structure there, basically, at the first level. And then you have a square root, a matrix square root, okay? Which is not an easy guy to handle. So the questions are first, okay? Under what conditions do you have a real square root, okay? So when a real square root G inverse F exists, okay, and it may not even be unique, but it's not necessarily a real square root may not exist actually, okay. And the second issue is that with for G and F you have different light cones, okay. So in principle, G and F can have completely different time directions. In GR you have this one matrix, so you can use coordinate transformations to adjust a given the time that to put a time direction in some component of G. Here, if you do that for G, you cannot do it for F. So in principle, F and G can have completely different time directions. Okay? And if that, okay. So when do G and F have a common time direction and a common spatial hypersurface? Okay. You need both of them. To formulate the initial value problem, you need a hypersurface which is a hyper, which is spatial with respect to both matrix, and you need a time direction which is common to both matrix. Okay. Otherwise, you cannot even start. Sorry. So this is just looking at one point in space. Just at one point, even at one point, do you have the structure or not? Okay. And then you can see whether the structure remains preserved under time evolution or not. So there are different questions. I'll give. I'll show you. No. So these two are different conditions. I'll show you now. Okay. I'll show you now. Okay. 1 minute. Sorry. Okay. I have them on that board. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So if these conditions are not satisfied, then you cannot even start doing an analysis of the time evolution of the system. Okay. And if this condition is not satisfied, then your theory does not exist. If the square root is not real, then your equations of motion are not real, the action is not real, then the theory does not exist. Okay? So you need both these conditions to be satisfied. And they are a priori not correlated. It's not obvious if they are related to each other. Okay? Now, the second condition, the structure of light cones for the two matrix, I write examples here. Okay, so this is how they can look like. Okay, so just at one point, take the space at this point, draw the light cone for the two matrix. You can have this. Okay, so here you have a common space like hypersurface. You have many of them, but you do not have a common time direction. Okay, in this case, the cones are very wide. They intersect. So in the intersection region, you can have a common time direction. Okay, but you cannot draw any space like surface through this configuration. So there is a common time, but there's no common spatial hypersurface. Okay? So clearly, in these cases, you cannot formulate the initial value problem. The theory does not make sense, even from the beginning. Okay? In this case, you have two light cones that actually intersect. Okay? And the intersection is in open set, so there actually is a non-zero set over which they intersect. Here, you have a time direction. You can choose a time direction somewhere in this common intersection. And you can have lots of space-like surfaces here. Okay, so again, you have a choice of space-like surfaces. You have a time direction. Okay, and so this is nice. Okay, and let me call this causally coupled cone. Okay, so at least locally, they're causally coupled. You have a proper initial value problem here. So there is always, in this case, there is always a wider cone that includes both of them. There's a smaller one that is the intersection of the two. And you can always have your time direction and spatial hypersurfaces. So you can at least start formulating the initial value problem here. Okay? Modulo the characteristic analysis, et cetera, that should be done later. Okay. The last case is here when the null cones just touch each other. Okay? In this case, you have neither a common time direction nor a common spatial hypersurface. Okay? You only have null directions. So the maximum you can do is to specify initial data on this null surface and look at time evolution on the other null direction, okay? Which doesn't work even for GR, basically. Okay? So these are the possibilities that you can have here. Okay? Modulo coordinate transformations. If you allow for coordinate transformations, you can actually also generate lots of other crazy-looking stuff, but at the end, they will reduce to one of these forms.
Yes. In the first case, is it obvious that it's a problem? Because I have a space-like surface. Okay. Why can't they solve it? Because I can take such a theory and then couple to another field which have light cone broad, which includes both of these. And then it would say it's okay.
But that would be...
That's probably in this theory also you can solve.
No, so I don't know. Okay, because in this theory, if you start formulating your problem, you start by defining canonical momenta. You want to go to the Hamiltonian formulation, suppose. Okay, what do you take as your time?
Because I have a family of hypersurfaces.
Yeah. But that label is not inside any one of these light cones.
No, but okay? I don't care.
So your lapses could become. Sorry, yes.
So why don't you just be completely open-minded about what time is and let the PDE tell you
That's a possibility, exactly, yeah. But that's much more involved in these situations.
But it seems okay.
So right now I'm telling you that if you have this guy, then you are very happy from the beginning. If you have that guy, maybe your suggestion may work. But from the beginning, I don't know if it will work or not. Okay. Okay. Now let's. But I'm not throwing away any one of them. Let's keep all of them from now. Let's keep all of them now.
In first case, we can define the rather con.
Right. Here. Yeah.
Including both.
Yeah. So
time erosion.
Yeah. No. So the larger cone means that you have a hypersurface. It does not mean that you have a common time direction. Yes. Yeah. But it's not all. If something like what you say happens, that you generate a new cone, effective cone. Otherwise, I don't think this will work. Well, maybe it will work. Okay.
I don't see PDE. No. Right. All I did, I want to pose Cauchy problem.
This is back when you have Cherenkov radiation. That's all this means is that if you have light propagates less than the speed of light in this room, and then you have sound that propagates less than the speed of light there.
Yeah. So let me put it this way. These are the possible situations. I'm not throwing away any one of them. Okay. If you get this one and it works, that's fine. I'm not throwing it away now. Okay? I keep it here. They're on the light cone, isn't it?
Well, but one mole can propagate on the left.
That's fine.
Another field can propagate on the right.
That's fine.
That's not a problem, right?
Yeah, that's not a problem. No.
But it's exactly what's.
No. That's just one light cone. This is here. You have two light cones. Let me proceed. I keep this. So you are happy if I keep it?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Okay. So these are the possibilities. Okay. Right now I'm not. Let me not say any. What do you want is good, which is bad. Sorry. Yes.
Helicity 0 and helicity 2. The characteristic is does not give the real diminu.
So, I'm not even talking about characteristics now. That will come later. Okay, you do that. I'm relying on you for that. Okay, I'm not doing that. Yeah. Now what's the theorem? Okay. So these are the two immediate problems that you can think of. Okay, the local causality issues that arise even before you go into the detailed analysis of characteristics, as you guys do. For massive gravity and the existence of the square root. Okay, so the theorem that I'm going to essentially show now is that a real square root exists if and only if f and g are either causally coupled like that or they are null coupled like that. Okay, so a real square root does not even exist for that in those that cases. Okay, so those cases are thrown away by the theory. Okay? I don't have to throw them away. Okay. So that's the main statement here. I'll comment on that at the end. Okay. So this is completely matrix formulation.
If you start with initial condition that the thing is real,
yeah.
Evolution does it?
No.
Can bring you
okay. No, that's here.
Okay.
Okay. So then you can actually show separately that the equation of motion. Once you start with this, the equation of motion keep the cones locked. They don't allow them to fall out. Okay? So that's guaranteed by the equation of motion. Okay? So even these two cases are disconnected. Equations of motion do not allow this guy to go into that guy. Okay? They are separate. Okay.
Sorry, but do they allow to go from CC to
equation? So to go from?
From CC to one of the left?
No. So CC will remain CC. Exactly. Okay. There are constraint equations that guarantee that basically. Okay. So those equations actually we knew from very like 3 years ago. Okay.
So the constraint equations that guarantee that relies on defining a Hamiltonian and a proper convolution.
So there we did it as a special case. We didn't know the general proof. Now with a general proof, you know that this is one case. Now if you start with this and define your Hamiltonian, then you'll see that the equations keep this locked. Okay? Okay, now there's also a converse to this theorem. The converse is that you can show that if you start from causally coupled cones, then you can prove that a square root always exists. So So this is an if and only if theorem. Okay? Both, it works both ways. Okay? So I will describe here only one way, that the square root, reality of square root implies this, but you can also do it the other way around, backward. Okay? Okay, so that's the theorem. So that means that if this is the case, then at least in the beginning, you don't have to worry about this, even though it may work. You already have a proper initial value problem, at least the way that you start with. So you write it, and then you look, then you do the kind of characteristic analysis that Izumi, for example, does, and then you see what happens, basically. Okay. So there may be problems later on, but you need this from the beginning. Okay. So at this level, this is essentially guaranteed by the structure of the theory in the matrix formulation with a square root. Okay. Okay. So yeah. So later on, then you have to supplement this with further analysis, but that's the beginning point. Okay. So now let me. How much time do I have? Ten minutes. Okay. So now let me try to outline how you go about proving that statement, basically. Okay. So that proof actually is in two steps. One is that if you look at G inverse F as a matrix, not the square root, but G inverse F. This is a real matrix, but it's not symmetric. So if you find this eigenvalues, it will have real eigenvalues, say lambda I, these are real. And you can also have complex eigenvalues, which appear in pairs. Okay, complex conjugate eigenvalues. So the eigenvalues have this structure. Okay. Now, there's a theorem that tells you that, so let me call this matrix A. So the theorem is that the square root, a real square root, exists in two situations.
So the
lambdas are the real eigenvalues of this guy, and A plus IVs are the complex eigenvalues of that matrix.
They're all eigenvalues of that.
They're all eigenvalues, yeah. So it can have a number of real eigenvalues, a number of complex eigenvalues, and the complex ones appear in pairs because it's the real matrix. Okay. So now a real square root exists in two conditions. One is that none of the real eigenvalues is negative. So essentially, on the complex plane, you should not have any eigenvalue that lies on the negative real axis. Okay? Under that condition, then you are guaranteed you're always guaranteed to have at least one real square root for this matrix, which is in fact what's called a principal square, which has nice properties.
So regardless of what the complex
eigenvalues. Complex is quite harmless, actually. Exactly. Yeah. And even though they're complex here, the square root actually is real. Okay? The square root will have imaginary eigenvalues, but the actual matrix is real. Okay, so that's an important thing. The square root of a real matrix is always real if there are no negative eigenvalues, okay? Irrespective of whether you have complex eigenvalues or not. Okay, that's one.
Does it matter whether it's diagonalizable or?
No, it's not. These are not diagonalizable. No. Yeah. So in fact, you prove this by going to draw the normal forms. Yeah. Okay. The second possibility is that if a certain eigenvalue is less than zero, okay, this itself is not a problem. The thing is that when you look at the Jordan, when you go to the canonic Jordan normal form for this matrix, so you have a Jordan block that will be like that, 1, 1, 0. That's a Jordan block, okay, of a given size, say n cross n. Okay, for the negative eigenvalue, you should have even number of such Jordan blocks in this matrix, basically. Okay? As long as you have even number of such Jordan blocks, for the negative eigenvalue, then again you have a real square root. Okay? So the real square root exists only in these two cases. Okay? And this is characterized in terms of the eigenvalues of the matrix A and its Jordan canonical form structure. Okay. Now this is okay, but this is in a very special coordinate system. This is the Jordan normal form structure. And directly from here, it's not obvious. So clearly these conditions, this implies conditions on G and F, on the matrix G mu nu and F mu nu. Okay? But a priori, here it's not obvious what the conditions are, because this statement is made in a very special coordinate system. So there are conditions on G and F, but we don't know, it's not obvious what this condition is. Okay? That, however, can be figured out by using another theorem. This is where Cedric defeats me. Okay. Okay. And that's called the canonical pair theorem. Okay. So the canonical pair theorem tells you that if you have any G inverse F, any two symmetric matrices G and F, then G inverse F will have a Jordan block structure like that. J's are the standard Jordan blocks. These correspond to the real eigenvalues, lambda I, and these are the real Jordan blocks corresponding to the complex eigenvalues. Okay? So these are real matrices. Okay? So these guys look like the Jordan block I wrote down. These guys look like matrices like lambda, 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 and then unit matrices here. Okay, where this lambda is like a b minus b a, okay, where a b and minus b a are these guys. So the Jordan matrix actually is real. Okay, you have complex eigenvalues, but the Jordan matrix is real. Okay, so this is a canonical. So for the matrix G inverse F, you can always write its Jordan normal form in that way. Now this theorem, this board doesn't move. Yeah, that's where I need more planning than Cedric. Okay. Now the theorem tells you that there's a unique structure for G and F when G inverse F is put in this form. And that is that there is a coordinate transformation Z transpose G Z and Z transpose F Z, okay, where these matrices take very special forms. So if I write it down, the G matrix is diagonal of the following blocks, epsilon 1, E1, up to epsilon Q, EQ, and then EQ plus 1 up to EP. Okay, what are the E's? The matrix E is extremely simple. It's like ones on this off diagonal element and zeros everywhere else. This is a permutation matrix. Okay. So, and these epsilons are just plus minus signs, and they're uniquely determined by the structure of the eigenvalues of J. Okay, depending on whether the eigenvalue is positive or negative. So epsilons are plus minus ones. They're uniquely determined. Okay.
So all these E's are the same matrix?
Their dimensions are different.
Their dimensions are
different. So the dimension of, say, of a given E is exactly the same as the dimension of the corresponding Jordan block here. So they are correlated to the Jordan blocks there, basically. Okay? And for F, the structure is again almost equally simple. It's this guy, E epsilon 1, E1, J1, etc. Okay, I don't have to, okay. And then like EP, CP. Okay? So for F, it's exactly the same form, except that each one of these guys is then multiplied by the corresponding Jordan block of G inverse F. Okay? So this is called the canonical pair theorem. And in fact, the proof of it involves just matrix algebra. Okay? Matrices with upper triangular, lower triangular forms, just manipulate them when you prove the theorem. Okay? So by using this canonical pair theorem, then you know that you can express G and so there exists a coordinate system locally where the structure of G and F are then uniquely determined by the Jordan decomposition of the G inverse F. Okay? Now once you have this, now you see what are the constraints. You had constraints here. This is of course true in general. Okay. Now you have a number of constraints. You are in three plus one dimensions. Okay. And you require, for example, the negative signatures of the G matrix is equal to one. You have one negative signature for the G matrix. The positive signatures of the G matrix is equal to three. Okay. And you have the same condition for F. The negative signature of the F matrix is one. Okay. But we are not imposing any restriction. Like we don't. This minus signature of the F matrix could be completely different from that of the G matrix. So they are not necessarily aligned here. Okay. And similarly, okay. But now you can also compute this number of negative and positive signatures. You can also compute them using these decompositions. Okay. So you get formulas for them. Okay. So if I write one, for example, so this would be like the number of negative signatures of EK plus negative signatures of EK, and K here goes from Q to P, and here K goes from 1 to Q. So essentially, you sum over the negative signature of this guys and those guys. Okay. So so there are formulas that you can. Yes. Yeah.
Is it a little bit surprising that knowing G inverse F allows you to separately write G and F? Why is that?
I found this completely surprising, but when I went through the proof, it's a proper proof. It's mathematics. So the point is that once you write down this Jordan canonical form here, this does not uniquely determine Z. So you can take many, many possible Zs that keep this exactly invariant. So first you find the class of all Zs that commute with this structure. Okay? And you get a certain, because these guys are very simple. These guys are just almost diagonal one extra thing. So the class of all Zs that commute with this guy can be found. Okay? Then you apply that class of Z to the G matrix. Okay? And then you find that those Zs have very nice properties. And just by applying them to the G matrix, you can see that you can always put the G matrix in that form. So the Z gives you enough freedom to put the G matrix in that form. And then once you have that, you combine that with this guy and compute the F matrix from there. Okay? So it's slightly lengthy, but rather straightforward analysis. Okay?
So these are the same Zs.
Exactly. And they're the same Z. They are real matrices and they are non-singular. They're invertible. Exactly. Okay? And that's an important point. You have to be able to do this with the same set of Zs. Yes. So this is like a local coordinate transformation at the point. Okay? Okay, so once you do this, now given these conditions, okay, you can actually enumerate all possible cases. And of course, now we have the condition that lambda is either real, the eigenvalues that enter into this block J are either all, positive, because we had a condition for the positivity of the square root that we discussed here. Okay, so we are either in this case or in that case. So we know that restriction also. So putting all these conditions together, you can exactly enumerate all the possibilities that you have. Okay? So it's just you can just get some four or five cases. Okay? And once you have those cases, then you know that in this coordinate system, for every structure of the G matrix, you get a structure for the F matrix. Okay? And then you just compute the light cones. Okay? And then it turns out that in all cases you get things like this, things that are kind of topologically equivalent to it. It's either like this, or one light cone is inside the other light cone. Okay? And there is one case in which you get this. Okay? So now, if you're conservative, like me, you would throw this away from the beginning. But if you are more adventurous, you can keep it and see what happens. Okay? But this gives you a classification of all possible cases. Exactly, from the beginning there, yeah, good. Okay. Okay, so I throw this away. Okay, I keep only that one. Okay, so now this means that I have at least I have a starting point to start with. And it also, okay, so this, first of all, to summarize, the reality condition on the square root matrix gives me this condition on the structure of the light cones, this local causality structure for the theory. On top of this, you can do coordinate transformation. Yes?
Actually, question about the physical meaning of these cones.
Yeah.
Would you say the F graviton would propagate within the cone of the F, and the G graviton would propagate within the cone of G, or not?
Okay. Naively, yes, except that because of the coupling, you actually have to do this analysis and figure out the actual propagating mode, and that could actually be different.
I mean, what do we know is, so, we know it's different. So roughly, the list D2 associated with G propagates in the G, and the list D2 associated with F propagates with F.
Okay.
Roughly.
Okay.
But the list D0, for sure, we know can propagate outside or inside of the outside.
Okay.
Because we know from the Galilean distribution.
Okay.
In two parts.
Yes.
Pick up the
spin
up
in
parts.
Okay. So that's the point.
You have,
and
sorry, Fawad.
Yes.
You have a further constraint on Lacan if you insist that you have finitely many square roots.
Sorry?
You have a further constraint on Lacan if you insist that you have finitely many square
roots. No, so that's an extra thing. Okay. So this condition does not depend on which one of the square roots you pick up.
Right, but okay? Even talking about which one, but
even
opposed finitely many as opposed to infinitely many square roots.
I think it's in this case that you have infinitely many. Is it?
I think you can have in the other case.
Even in the other cases, yeah. You mean what's called the non-proper.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So
continuously many infinitely.
So that is no constraint here. Okay. So in fact, that was one of my next comments. That the square root is not unique. You have many square roots, but this structure does not depend on which one of the square roots you pick up. Okay? Because the theorem tells you that you need these conditions to have at least one real square root. You may have many more, you don't care. Okay? So for this, we only need that condition. Now, the question of the multitude of square roots, that comes in, and that's very interesting. That will come in for the kind of analysis that George and Kisugi were talking about. Okay? That when you do the characteristic analysis, that result may depend on which one of the square roots you pick up. Okay? So there, in fact, so we know that there are some kind of criteria that out of this multitude of square roots, which ones you should pick up. We have to look at that in more detail. But you can see that some of them look nicer, some of them don't look nicer, again, in terms of light cost. Yeah.
So, when you have a real square root, so there's this criterion that says that the symmetry constraint for some Fourier binds is obtained. So why don't you just go in that case go to the Fourier bind?
Okay.
And then
so that's
you don't care about which square root. Is.
Very good. Okay, that was the second. That was my second comment. So both of you preempted my comments. Okay, so that was a question also. I think that you could ask. So. A corollary of this essentially is that if you look at a Fourier-bind formulation, you have two possibilities. One is that the Fourier-binds are exactly symmetrizable, and therefore they're equivalent to the square root. In that case, you have exactly this case. Okay? The other corollary is that in cases where the Fourier-bind formulation is not equivalent to the metric formulation, then you do not have this kind of interlocked light cones. You have things like that or like that. Okay?
Yeah, but you said that the characteristic analysis depends on the choice of the square roots. Yeah. In this. But if
No. Okay.
So but I don't know. I don't understand because it's if now I know that in this case where there is a real square root, I can go to Fourier-bind formulation.
No.
It doesn't seem to depend on
anything. No. So the point is that I would think that if the symmetrization condition for the Fourier bind is equivalent to the square root thing, then that condition will have many solutions. So even in the Fourier bind case, you will have all the solutions.
Okay.
So the problem becomes exactly the same, essentially, in that case. Okay. And for this metric square, you have theorems. You can look at them. Maybe in that case also you have theorems, but the problem should be exactly the same. Okay. Thank you.